I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The long-awaited climate change bill debuts on Capitol Hill today, and it's not clear whether this is, as one political pundit suggested, the exactly wrong or perfectly right time for this legislation, because with millions of gallons of oil spewing into the Gulf of Mexico, the bill actually expands offshore drilling. Massachusetts Democrat John Kerry and Connecticut Independent Joe Lieberman are unveiling the 1,000-page measure called the American Power Act bill. Among other things, it would set the first ever mandatory caps on greenhouse gas emissions, and to get it passed, they're leaving in things that were meant to attract Republicans, such as expanded offshore oil drilling and provisions that would give coastal states more say over offshore drilling. Joining us on the line from Washington is Stephen Mufsin, who covers energy issues for The Washington Post. And Stephen, this bill is coming forward today, even though it lost its only Republican support from South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham. How do you explain this bill's debut? Why right now?
Well, I think now because it's as good a time as any. I think that the prospects of the political climate improving aren't that good, and the majority leader has said that perhaps they could actually debate this thing in June if they can squeeze it into the calendar. So I think that Kerry and Lieberman, who have done an awful lot of work trying to patch something together that will appeal to a lot of different interest groups, figured, well, let's just go ahead and see what happens.
And how would offshore drilling expand exactly under this measure?
Well, it expands it in a way very similar to what the president outlined in late March. It would make expanded drilling possible in parts of the central Gulf of Mexico that were previously off limits. Also along the coasts of the southeastern United States, where there's a lot of support for offshore drilling, and in some parts of Alaska. What it doesn't do is it does not open up drilling, would not open up drilling off California or New Jersey, places like that where there's a lot of opposition to drilling. There is a change, of course, because of this disaster. I think there's they tweak the provision that allows states to block drilling not only in their own states if they so choose, but also in adjacent states.
And what would they have to do to try to block it? What would one state have to do to try to block drilling in another state?
I think it would require an act of the state legislature. That's how I understand it.
But, you know, this legislation is a climate change bill, really. It's setting goals for greenhouse gas reductions and a cap and trade system for utilities. Can you explain how those things would work?
Well, there are 12 parts of this bill. So, and yes, it's a climate bill, but the climate bill is also in many ways an energy bill, since that's where the emissions are coming from, our entire energy industry. So, I mean, some of the highlights are that it provides some more loan guarantees for nuclear power plants and some other incentives for nuclear power. It establishes a cap and trade system, which is a system that sets limits on carbon emissions by utilities and allows them to trade credits so that it makes it a little easier to get under those targets. It does a whole lot of other things too. It has some incentives for cleaner clean energy technologies and incentives for research and development on carbon capture and storage, something that's still quite expensive and unproven, but many people think is crucial if we're going to hit climate targets because we use so much coal in this country for electricity.
And just briefly, Stephen, is it significantly different from the measure that was passed in the House?
It is. It's much more industry friendly, I should say. I think some of the targets have been modified. There is a price collar, they call it, which essentially establishes a floor and a ceiling on carbon prices to make sure that the impact on the economy and on consumers and companies is not too great. There's a change in the provisions on transportation fuels to try to bring the oil companies on board, and that's kind of complicated, but seems to be more amenable to the petroleum industry.
So a lot of negotiating ahead.
Well, this is a negotiation that's already happened, actually. I mean, the attempt, I think, has been to try to bring different interest groups on
Stephen,
board.
Thanks very much for being with us. Stephen Mufsin is a Washington Post financial reporter who covers the energy industry. Four decades after President Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs, the White House has outlined a national drug policy that treats illegal drug use as a public health issue, with a shift in the focus from law enforcement to treatment and prevention. The plan is the first drug strategy unveiled by the Obama White House. It calls for reducing the rate of youth drug use by 15% over the next 5 years. Joseph Califano has been studying substance abuse in the U.S. for the past 20 years. He founded the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. He's a former Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he's out with a new book titled How to Raise a Drug-Free Kid. And Joseph Califano joins us in the studio. Mr. Califano, let's start with some statistics. You say over the past 12 years, the abuse of prescription drugs has really skyrocketed.
Our report showed that teenage abuse of prescription drugs, of painkiller stimulants and depressants, was up 212%. It's the fastest growing part of teenage drug use. And the education they need to do really is both of kids and of parents. Of kids to get them to understand that these drugs aren't safe. They think they're safe. And, you know, when mom takes Valium, she's easy to deal with. So why don't I take Valium? And that's one piece. But the other piece are parents. At least half of the prescription drugs being abused by 12 to 17-year-olds are coming out of mommy and daddy's medicine cabinet. Daddy may be taking OxyContin because he's got severe back pain, but, you know, Johnny takes one pill, doesn't take it, he crushes it and gets a real high. And OxyContin is really, it's almost legalized heroin. When they run out of mommy and daddy's medicine cabinet and they have to go out on the street and buy it, in most places, it's more expensive than heroin, and many of these kids switch to heroin.
Your center took a look at how much we're spending on substance abuse, how much state, local, and the federal government are all spending on substance abuse, and those numbers are pretty alarming as well.
Well, they are. We're spending hundreds of billions of dollars, and the most alarming number of all the money, the billions of dollars that the states spend on substance abuse and addiction and the problems they cause, the crime, the homelessness, the health care costs. Of every dollar spent, 96 cents goes to shovel up, we call it, shoveling up the consequences, shoveling up the crime, shoveling up the rapes and the assaults, shoveling up the homelessness, shoveling up the child welfare system, where 70% of the kids in this country in child welfare are there because of drug and alcohol abusing parents. And only 4 cents, goes to prevention and treatment. On the National Drug Strategy, look, the words are great. The issue is, what's the follow-up? Are they going to revamp the budget that was originally sent to Congress, which basically left it the way it has been for the last several years?
So there's been no increase in money for prevention and treatment?
No change. The budget is essentially two-thirds for interdiction and law enforcement, and one-third for prevention and treatment.
You know, a while ago Here and Now spoke with Dr. Thomas McClellan. He's the number two person at the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and we should tell our listeners they can listen to that interview at hereandnow.org at our website. Dr. McClellan, who, by the way, has a very compelling personal story. He lost his son to addiction. He said at the time that there needs to be more of an emphasis on prevention and treatment and that we were going in the wrong direction. Do you think it's folks like him who are influencing this, and this is at least maybe there isn't the money behind it just yet, but at least it's a step in the right direction? Or how do you view it?
Well, I think people like that are very important. But, you know, we need a crusade here, like the crusade about breast cancer. We need a major effort. We're talking about the country's number one disease. I see the anguish of parents, and I see the concern. In the United States of America, 20% of 12 to 17-year-olds can get marijuana in an hour. 40% can get it in a day. The same is true with respect to prescription drugs. That means we're talking about 10 to 12 million 12 to 17-year-olds can get their hands on marijuana or prescription drugs in a day.
So this is a very different world of substances than what many parents probably remember from when they were that age.
Absolutely. And what that says, it says, well, they're not buying that stuff from some guy in a dirty trench coat in a bad section of town. They're buying it from their classmates and their friends. So parents should know who their classmates and friends are.
You know, when you talk about the availability of drugs, I remember when I was in high school, drugs were widely available, too. It was easy to find marijuana. It was easy to find certain types of pills, certainly not OxyContin or things like that. But you could find pills or acid or mushrooms or things like that. What's the big change now? Are you saying it's more, it's easier to get, it's more widely available, there's more pressure? What is it?
I think there are a lot of cultural changes. I think parents holding down two jobs, parents aren't there, parents really not understanding that world. The internet is a cornucopia of how to buy drugs, how to make drugs. You know, you go on the internet and find out how to get high fast, slow, how to buy, you can buy marijuana, you can learn how to grow hydroponic marijuana, you can learn what happens if you mix this booze with this pill, all of that. And don't have any illusions. Kids are curious. They're looking at that.
So then, with all of those cultural influences, it seems like it would be incredibly difficult to raise a drug-free kid.
Well, there are no silver bullets, but there's no question that parental engagement is critically important, that being involved in your kid's life, talking to your kid, listening to your kid, sending a clear message. We ask kids who do not drink or use drugs, why don't you do that? The overwhelming reason is my parents would raise hell if I did it. My parents would really be angry. So parental attitude, parental conduct is important. And there are simple things that may be hard to do in the busy world we live in. But we learned in 1991 that kids who always had dinner with their parents were far less likely to smoke, drink, and use drugs than kids who never had dinner with their parents. We've calibrated that every year from 0 to 7. And it's a straight line. The more often kids have dinner with their parents, the less likely they are to smoke, drink, and use drugs. It's an easy way to know what your kid is, you know, when your kid is high and low and stressed and what have you.
You know, they sound like very sort of commonsensical, almost old-fashioned kind of things. You know, have dinner together. I just wonder, are those measures enough, really, to counter that kind of pressure to do drugs?
Well, I think They significantly reduce the risk. I mean, if you get a child through age 21 without smoking, without abusing alcohol, and without using illegal drugs, that kid is virtually certain to be home free for the rest of their life. We know that virtually every adult hooked on cigarettes was hooked as a teenager. We know that teenagers who binge drink are much likely to become alcoholics or alcohol abusers later on in life. We know that virtually nobody starts smoking pot at 25 or snorting coke. And what it says to us is the government has an obligation, and, you know, not doing very well in keeping drugs from getting through the border and running down big drug lords. But the basic obligation here falls on the family.
That's Joe Califano. He's founder of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. When we come back, more advice for parents about how to try to keep kids off drugs. We'll be back in a minute. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Joseph Califano. He's studied substance abuse for the past 20 years as founder of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. His new book is titled How to Raise a Drug-Free Kid. And before the break, Joe, you were saying that parents need to spend more time with their kids and have a better idea of what their children are up to. Is there anything being done to give more support to parents who, as you said, are working more and may not always be around?
Okay, support for parents. It should come in good part from other parents. And this is an example. It's another tough case, but it happens all the time. We get questions about it all the time. Your kid says, Mom, Sally's smoking pot. Or he says, you know, my friend John, he gets pretty drunk every Saturday night. But you cannot tell his mother. The one thing that might help Sally or John is if you do tell his mother. If your kid were telling you that about your sister's or brother's daughter or son, you'd call your sister or brother. So kind of treat it like a family. Some schools now say when your kid goes into high school, We have all the parents come in. We want you to sign an agreement that you will not serve alcohol at parties and a whole host of other things.
When you talk about other parents and other parents allowing kids to do certain things and the whole pressure to be a friend versus a parent with kids, one parent I remember reading in the book said that they actually told their child's friend's mother that the friend had been doing something wrong, and it really did some damage, long-lasting damage to the parent-child relationship there. So that is, it's certainly a factor that parents have to consider. It's a difficult balance to try to strike.
You're absolutely right. And I put that in there because I want, you know, in doing this book, we posted on our website, Parents Tell Us Your Experiences. We got hundreds and hundreds of experiences. And there's no question that's one of the risks. That can go to how you do it. And the issue for a parent is whether it's worth taking. You know, on the other hand, there's the story of the dentist in Baltimore who overheard his kid putting together a buy of marijuana for 12 kids. He called all of those parents, tried to get them to come to his house, invited them. Only two parents came, and ultimately, no parents did anything. Sadly, this particular parent's child died of an overdose. I think I would opt to take the risk. I know that I put that in the book because I wanted mothers to realize when you do this, your daughter may really get angry, and it may take a while to get over it. But I would bet that in another year or two, that daughter will be saying, you know, you were right, Mom.
So basically your advice is stay connected, know what they're doing, have regular dinners together, treat everyone as a family, make sure that you're a cohesive group with schools and with other parents. But I wonder, what about the belief that it's a phase? The teens go through a phase, they experiment, and just let it ride itself out. And a lot of people smoke pot, drink, and they are able to be successful, functioning adults.
Just take the college thing. I mean, of 100 kids that binge drink in college, 20, 25 are going to become alcoholics. 75 are going to go to work and get straightened out. The problem is the risk is high, and you can reduce the risk. And I note in here, forget about privacy. Can I search my child's room? The answer is yes, of course. If you think there's pot in that room, go search. Well, no privacy. This is not a privacy issue. This is a tough, complicated disease. It's neurological. We know that now from the brain. It's emotional. It's psychological. It's spiritual. The medical community has not given it the attention in terms of research that it deserves. The practicing physicians have not given it the attention they should in their practices. The public health community has not mounted the kind of education campaign they did for AIDS, and they're now doing for obesity. But the parents have got to be there. Nobody else is going to be there for them. And this book says, you're a parent, this will help you reduce the risk that your kid will get into this stuff. We wrote it because, as you know, Deb, most of the questions we get at a research center are from researchers, from people like you that want facts for the media, from people in public policy and state government, federal government. But beyond that, the number one source of our emails and phone calls were parents saying, what do I do? What do I do in this world my kid is growing up in? And out of that, we found out, one, they don't know what that world is like. They have no idea, and this will tell them. And two, they have no idea how to cope with it. And this hopefully will give them some practical, simple ideas.
Joseph Califano is the founder and chairman of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. His new book is titled How to Raise a Drug-Free Kid, The Straight Dope for Parents. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's been great to be with you.
In Britain, former rivals David Cameron and Nick Clegg say their new coalition government represents a new era in British politics. The coalition, Britain's first since World War II, is an unlikely marriage between Cameron's right-wing Conservative Party and the left-leaning Liberal Democrats, led by Clegg. But today at No. 10 Downing Street, Cameron, the new prime minister, said they'll see past their differences.
We have a shared agenda and a shared resolve to tackle the challenges our country faces, to safeguard our national security and support our troops abroad, to tackle the debt crisis, to repair our broken political system, and to build a stronger society.
Rob Watson is the BBC's political correspondent. He joins us from London. And Rob, give us a sense of what it feels like there today. Is this like a political earthquake for Britain?
It certainly is quite extraordinary. I have been covering British politics for the last 30 years. I have never seen anything quite like it. And frankly, I don't think anybody alive in Britain will have seen anything quite like it either. This was a coalition that's in a way been forced on the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats by the arithmetic of the election. But both men really seem to be embracing it.
So it was the arithmetic, because initially we thought that former Prime Minister Gordon Brown's Labour Party might be able to work out a deal with the Liberal Democrats. What exactly happened there?
I think in one way it was both parties, both the Liberal Democrats and Labour, realising that such a coalition might be seen by the electorate, by the voters, as a coalition of the losers, seeing as both parties had lost votes. I think it was also the case that any arrangement that would have kept Gordon Brown in power, even if for just a few more months, would have been very hard to sell to the people of Britain. And then I suspect, based on what we've seen now of the personal chemistry between Mr. Clegg and Mr. Cameron, I suspect a lot of it was just the idea that Mr. Clegg and his Liberal Democrat Party couldn't really see themselves working with Labour.
But these two parties are far apart on several issues. What do you think is the major one?
I think rather than picking out an issue, I would talk more about the soul and the DNA and the hearts of these parties, which are very, very different. As you say, the Liberal Democrats are very much a left of centre party. Indeed, quite a few of the members of the Liberal Democrat Party used to be part of Labour. So they have a very, very different history, a very different kind of zeitgeist. The Conservative Party, on the other hand, a very old party, is very much at the centre-right, a party that believes in free enterprise, smaller government, the importance of the private sector. And it does seem a very, very unlikely marriage indeed. And when people ask, well, does that mean to say it couldn't possibly work? Well, if you'd asked me a few days ago, I'd have said it's inconceivable. But I think the two parties are now locked together in a way, and I think they're either going to stand or fall together.
What do you think the new government means for Britain's relationship with the United States? Both Cameron and Clegg have said that the Labour government was too close with the U.S. So you think we'll see a dramatic change there in the relationship with the U.S.?
Absolutely not, no. I do think that there'll be a considerable amount of continuity between the two governments.
Any change about policy in Afghanistan?
Not, I don't think, in the foreseeable future. And all of the parties in Britain before the election were pretty much committed to the idea that Britain has to stay the course in Afghanistan. But of course, all of the major parties in Britain, including the ones now in this coalition government, would not want to stay in Afghanistan any longer than they have to. But will we see some dramatic change in policy? I don't think so, no.
And finally, what about how David Cameron might fare when it comes to the verbal back and forth in Parliament? He's used to being the attacker, and now that he's in charge, it's likely he'll be the attacked. Do you think he'll handle that well?
Well, you know, Deborah, you have raised a fascinating question that was raised at their joint press conference, because suddenly we've got a whole different dynamic. So all those people who like watching British Parliament on C-SPAN, I think they're going to be in for a bit of a shock in future, because normally Prime Minister's question time, you've seen Gordon Brown having to take questions from the leaders of two opposition parties. Now what's going to happen? There's only one opposition party, the Labour Party. And here's something else that people are really going to have to grapple with. When Mr. Cameron is away, Mr. Clegg will answer questions. Someone from another party, it's just extraordinary.
Well, we'll be watching and listening. Thanks, Rob.
Thank you, Deborah.
Rob Watson is the BBC's political correspondent. Up next, formaldehyde is used in everything from corpses to carpets, but research links it to leukemia. So why does the EPA still list it as a probable carcinogen? That's up next, here and now. How the federal government assesses a chemical's risk to the public's health is a lengthy, complicated process. Our next guest says that the review of the risks of formaldehyde is even murkier than usual, and that's because of politics. Joaquin Sapien, a reporter for ProPublica.org, has been looking at the process of assessing the risks of formaldehyde, which is a chemical in dozens of products, especially carpet and plywood. Right now, there is a debate about whether the Environmental Protection Agency or the National Academy of Sciences should be doing this assessment. Welcome, Joaquin.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, can you tell us how often we come in contact with formaldehyde?
Formaldehyde's a fairly ubiquitous chemical. As you said, it's highly concentrated in carpet and plywood, and it's actually a key ingredient in industrial adhesives. So it's in particle board, it's in plywood, it's even shown up in Victoria's Secret bras. There's a lawsuit about that right now. So it's really everywhere.
And now it's been classified by the Environmental Protection Agency as a probable carcinogen, not a known carcinogen. Isn't that right? That's where the risk assessment stands at this point.
That's right.
If the EPA says that formaldehyde is only a probable carcinogen, what are some of the health risks?
Well, right now the focus of the debate really is centered upon formaldehyde's link to leukemia. And there have been several high-profile, highly credible studies from places like the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the National Toxicology Program, and the National Cancer Institute, which say that formaldehyde does cause leukemia. And right now, the EPA doesn't recognize it as such.
And formaldehyde really became an issue after Hurricane Katrina when Gulf residents were put in FEMA trailers where they were constantly exposed to formaldehyde. And then we saw some other health risks aside from leukemia from prolonged exposure to formaldehyde. Isn't that right?
That's correct. A lot of trailer occupants complained about having severely irritated eyes, frequent nosebleeds, migraine headaches, respiratory problems, severe coughing, wheezing, talked about it triggering asthma attacks, and all of these are symptoms that, you know, many scientific bodies recognize as being consequent of prolonged formaldehyde exposure.
Now, why just FEMA trailers? Why was the exposure so great in those trailers?
Well, the levels of formaldehyde were just very, very high in the plywood and other materials that were used in those trailers, and through congressional investigations, we ended up learning that part of the reason why that was just because the products that were used weren't baked out for long enough. And so basically, when you produce something like plywood or particle board with a lot of formaldehyde, you're supposed to heat it up so that you can trigger the off-gassing before you actually install it in a trailer. And the manufacturers were trying to make these trailers so fast that they had skipped that step. And the plywood came in sort of almost wet with formaldehyde and was off-gassing at the time. And in fact, even workers that were building those trailers complained about these kinds of symptoms.
Now, the story that you wrote about assessing the risk of formaldehyde also, because of the FEMA trailers, points to Louisiana Senator David Vitter and his ties to the industry and what's exactly happening with the risk assessment. Can you briefly explain the connection that you've made there?
We find that Senator Vitter's position on formaldehyde is sort of ironic because, frankly, there are very few ordinary Americans that actually care about formaldehyde. And most of them probably live in Senator Vitter's state because they lived in FEMA trailers. And yet the senator is basically doing the industry's bidding when it comes to the assessment of this chemical. I mean, he placed a hold on the nomination of a key EPA official until the EPA agreed to send this risk assessment through yet another round of review. And this is something that the industry has been advocating for many, many years.
Why would Senator Vitter and the industry prefer a review by the National Academy of Sciences versus the EPA?
Well, the National Academy of Sciences, first of all, has been criticized by many Democrats in Congress as well as public health watchdogs for being a little bit more friendly toward the industry. I mean, they certainly have a good reputation as being credible, but there are sometimes panelists that land on the National Academy of Sciences reviews who have written studies on behalf of chemical companies or have gotten money to author other programs for those industries. And so the industry felt as though they'd maybe get a friendlier review from the National Academy of Sciences as opposed to the EPA. And when you have that level of detailed scientific review, you're almost guaranteed to find some criticism. And whether that criticism is big or small, the industry will latch onto it and say that, you know, because The National Academy of Sciences had some small quibble with the EPA. It has to go through yet another round of review, and the EPA has to take another year to respond to the National Academy of Sciences. And the longer this delay lasts, the longer you are guaranteed to operate under the current regulatory structure, which the industry perceives to be more friendly than what might come out of a more stringent chemical review.
What did Senator Vitter say in response to your story about his connections to the industry and possibly that influencing his proposals to do this assessment of formaldehyde or not do it, as the case may be?
Well, it took several phone calls and emails before I ever heard back from Senator Vitter's office on this story, literally calling them every day for weeks. And when we were finally ready to go to print, they sent a letter that showed that three other Democratic lawmakers had also supported this review. And they also pointed out that under the Bush administration, the EPA ended up advocating to send the formaldehyde assessment to the National Academy of Sciences as well.
Okay, so now that it is with the National Academy of Sciences, this assessment of formaldehyde, do we know when we might get an idea of exactly what the formal policy might be on formaldehyde?
It's supposed to be going to the NAS sometime by the end of the month, and at that point, the current review will be made public, so it'll be interesting to see what the connection is to formaldehyde there. And then it's supposed to take a year for the NAS to review it, and then depending on how critical the review is of the EPA's draft, it could take some time for the EPA to respond to the NAS's comments.
Joaquin Sapien, a reporter for ProPublica.org, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Just a reminder, you can listen to our show stream live on our website, hereandnow.org, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at hereandnow. And before we go today, parents of special needs children write about their lives and their sometimes conflicted feelings about themselves and their kids. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. At least 12% of all children in the United States have disabilities or special needs. For their parents, that can mean a lifetime of working, often fighting, to get the care to meet those needs. While these men and women are often called heroes for their efforts, many parents of disabled kids say in reality they don't feel that way. They often feel conflicted and guilty and angry, and they write about those feelings in a new book of essays titled My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. Some of the parent writers recently read their essays at a bookstore in Boston. Here are moms Stephanie Sleeper, Jennifer Silverman, and Charisse Ingram.
A few months back, my next-door neighbor, Anna, mentioned that she was co-teaching a graduate-level class in social work at Hunter College on autistic spectrum disorders. Since she felt it was important for her students to understand what kind of impact their work will eventually have from the other end, the client end, would I be interested in speaking to them for maybe 45 minutes one evening? Oh, would I ever. I talked and talked and talked, and then I talked some more. I could not squeeze in all the things I so desperately wanted them to know. Like how people look at my family and the assumptions and the projections begin, and yet when we start talking and demonstrate that we know what we're talking about with regard to our children's diagnosis and care, we can literally see them reassess us. And how, even though it felt like a big relief rather than bad news to finally get an accurate diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome for my daughter 3 years ago, it was really, really hard to deal with the possibility of having not one but two special needs children after my son was referred for an evaluation this past winter. I talked about how this is my job now, how even as annoying as it is to have people tell me all the time, "I don't know how you do it," as though I have the option to stop, I know that we are lucky that I am able to stay home and have this be my 24/7, full-time, completely unpaid, no-benefits job. I am completely overwhelmed nearly all the time, and yet, other than the same household responsibilities that everyone has, this is all I have to take care of. I talked about my daughter's food intolerances and her sensory issues and how finally last summer I just stopped fighting at her every single night and just allowed her to have the same two dinners over and over and over because I couldn't stand it anymore. I talked about how there is no aspect of our lives that this doesn't affect, how I don't even think about certain aspects of the accommodations we've made anymore. Of course there are certain kinds of clothes that I don't even think about buying for my daughter because they'll be scratchy or distracting. Of course it takes two people to brush my son's teeth because he has such extreme oral defensiveness. There are a million and one other things that we just do without even thinking about it because that's how life is for us now. I told them. I didn't sign up for any of this when I got pregnant. I thought I was just having a baby. Increasingly, I feel as though I am drowning, not waving. Burnout, becoming depressed and unable to do what must be done and failing my kids, frightens me so terribly that I cannot allow myself to even think about it. Part of maintaining the balancing act is never, ever, ever looking down.
As parents of differently abled children, we are often put on pedestals. People wonder in awe about how we cope or hand us platitudes about how we have landed in a different but wonderful country where we simply need to dream new dreams for our special angel children. But when we're out in public, our special angel children are most often stared at and treated like enigmas. Our children are inconvenient, awkward, and difficult. Their parents, even those of us with a lot of tattoos, are usually struggling mightily to be less obtrusive. Those who wonder aloud how we do it are really just highlighting for themselves and us that they'll never have to. The truth is that our kids aren't angels, they're people with big challenges, and their challenges make our lives as parents incredibly complicated, messy, and sometimes heartbreaking, no matter how much we love them.
As many people have told me over the past few years, my son doesn't look special needs. Yes, he makes eye contact. No, you can't see the scars unless you look closely. Both of his diagnoses are fairly invisible. If you saw him in a grocery store, you'd think he was a pretty typical kid. Average height, if skinny, and ravishingly cute, if I do say so myself. Not blue, unless he gets cold or overexerted. And if it were a good day, you would probably tell me that he doesn't seem autistic at all to you. In fact, am I sure that he is autistic? The invisibility of his diagnoses is both his greatest misfortune and my greatest source of guilt. It may seem odd to say that having invisible diagnoses is a misfortune. After all, he can generally pass for normal in polite society. But I don't want him to pass. I want everyone to know how hard he tries to say hello to his teacher when she says good morning to him, to take turns with his sister, to cope with an unexpected extra errand on the way home. He has more resilience than half the adults I know. I don't want his struggles and his achievements, minor though they may seem to a lot of people, to be invisible. Being autistic and having a bum heart are part of who he is. I want everyone to see his scars. As for the guilt, I think that's obvious. He could have been born with a much, much worse heart defect. He could have died. There are other kids in the pages of this book whose lives will probably be more difficult than his. Thinking about these kids is supposed to make me feel blessed or lucky. It doesn't. It makes me feel rotten for thinking the life with him is so difficult, and it makes me feel angry that I'm supposed to believe that special needs is a gift. The Iraq War started the night before my son's second surgery. I had been vaguely aware of the build-up to the war as something I would probably be very angry about if I were living in the same world as everyone else. But we were waiting for more surgery. He was not quite 3 months old. We shared a room with another little girl who was in heart failure and on the transplant list. She was watching Dora the Explorer on her TV. We had the news on, but the sound turned down. I remember watching scenes of invasion, bombing, and destruction, but instead of the endless chatter about how short the war would be and how we were saving the Iraqi people from a terrible dictator, the soundtrack was the beep-beep of the machinery with occasional alarms as his pulse dropped back into the 60s. I kept glancing over at Dora and her giant eyes, and at the little girl, staring wide-eyed herself as her mom curled up next to her in the bed. This is not a blessing. It is not a gift. I'm not supposed to feel this way. I'm supposed to believe that God only gives me what I can handle, and that God gave me this child because he knew I was the best parent for the job. And somewhat contradictorily, he gives me what I need and not what I want. I know religion is a great source of comfort to many families with special needs children. I do not make light of their beliefs any more than I want to negate the challenges that ordinary parents face. We special needs parents are always expected to put a happy face on our lives. Oh yeah, the surgery went great. He had a bit of trouble with bleeding, but you know, it's okay now. Or, oh, she's transferring schools again. We're sure this new one that is over an hour away will work out much better. People want to hear that we're dealing just fine. They want to know that we believe that having a special needs child is a gift so that they feel less guilty that their own children are healthy, able-bodied, and typical. There, but for the grace of God, you know. The guilt that parents of typical healthy children feel is my guilt, too. When I read on the HeartMonth's internet boards about another heart child who did not make it through a surgery, I know that I am no different from other parents of healthy kids. My child lived. Thank you.
Writers and parents Stephanie Sleeper, Cherise Ingram, and Jennifer Silverman reading from the book of essays titled My Baby Rides the Short Bus, The Unabashedly Human Experience of Raising Kids with Disabilities. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young is back tomorrow. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.